From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Our mission is to equip you in truth with sound biblical teaching and spiritual discernment as a foundation for experiencing the authentic Christian life through fellowship with God and Christ. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present another episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Megan Allman, a speaker with Life Training Institute and author of an article in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal, What's in a Name? A Growing Trend to Abolish the Labels Pro-Choice and Pro-Life. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to you. Today, I have the opportunity to interview someone who knows a whole lot about cultural apologetics. Her name is Megan Allman. She's a speaker with Life Training Institute. She addresses audiences, trains students on pro-life apologetics. And she's the author of an article in the Christian Research Journal, Seeing Red, The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. This is an incredible article. If you haven't seen this article, you can find it on the web at equip.org. Megan Allman, I am delighted to have you on Hank Unplugged.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's an honor to be on Hank Unplugged. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, The Handmaid's Tale is no longer considered by cultural elites to be dystopian. It is now largely rendered prescient, a prophecy currently realized on the stage of history in a government that separates mothers from children, in a government that is imbibing the horror of ICE, in a government that is installing travel bans alleged to keep millions of peace-loving Muslims out of the United States, in a government that is state-sponsored effort to silence truth-loving journalists, in a government that is precipitating newsroom slaughters carried out by right-wing activists, and in an all-out war against female reproductive rights, a democracy that is in chaos due to the implementation of biblical rather than progressive values. In other words, what's going on right now is we are in the epicenter of a storm, and in that epicenter of the storm is the abortion debate. I was listening to a TV show. It was the 4th of July special for Michelle Wolf, and she leads off with this salute to abortion. And the salute was, God bless abortions. God bless America. And when she said, God bless abortions, God bless America, on the 4th of July, people went crazy. She said, women don't forget, you have the power to give life, and men are trying to control that. Don't let them. Well, here's the thing, Mick. We have to now combat this kind of, well, it's propaganda. And the propaganda is being bought into quite uncritically. When you watch the audience, they are cheering her on. She is making sophomoric arguments, but she's winning with a platform. And I once heard a quote, and it's often attributed to Napoleon and various icons of the past. I don't know who this really comes from, but I think it's apropos. It is, if I can control your media and your music, I care not who makes your laws. And today, the media is pushing this abortion debate, and Christians have to be always ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within them with gentleness and with respect. When you first heard the implications of abortion being spelled out by Scott Klusendorf, you made a transition in your life.
Yes. I was actually working as a journalist prior to this. I was a reporter for a community newspaper in a a pretty sizable town in Georgia where I'm from, and covered a crisis pregnancy center's fundraising banquet. Typically, the pregnancy centers will have them once a year. Most of them raise their money for the year that way. And because it was a community event, they sent me to cover the event, and Scott was the speaker at the banquet. And I remember being absolutely floored by the presentation that he gave. And it wasn't just that the presentation was on pro-life apologetics. I myself would have called myself pro-life. I'd never been equipped with the tools to talk about it the way that he was approaching it. But the entire idea that you could speak about something related to your Christian convictions in such a compelling and winsome way to a secular world. It was the apologetics that drew me in. And I went home and told my husband, something has to change. This has affected me so. And my husband, the great man that he is, made the decision that we should send me back to school so that I could tell these types of stories instead. And so the rest of the story took a couple of years to unwind, but the short story is, and Scott says it this way, I bugged him till he hired me. I wouldn't put it that way, but that's what he says, so we'll go with that.
You know, Michelle Wolf is calling the slogan a propaganda slogan. When you say that you're part of the pro-life movement, what she's suggesting is that you have made a propaganda statement. And that through that, you are twisting the minds of people to think that there's something wrong with abortion.
Yes. Well, it's the rhetoric. And as you were talking about a minute ago, the words that are out there, there's so many common terms that people care about, this set of values. We care about equality. We care about equal opportunities for men and women, sexual freedom. Freedom is a term that's thrown around a lot, but what those terms really mean or where they come from are where we differ, and that's what's often overlooked, what's behind the rhetoric. And when it comes to the abortion issue, there are a lot of assumptions being made about who counts in the human family, who counts among us, what is a person with value, and who gets to define who that is and what that is. And that's really where we camp out when we're doing pro-life apologetics, in order to make that clear so that we can then move forward.
Well, let's talk about that. What would make abortion okay?
Well, any other justification that you can give for taking innocent human life, that would make abortion okay, which I don't think there is one. Because really what we're talking about at the center of the abortion issue is, what is this entity that we're talking about? The entire debate hinges on the question, what is the unborn? What is this thing we're talking about? We can throw around justifications all day long, and we hear them. And I'm well aware in this line of work that the justifications that are out there deal with important matters. Privacy, for example, is not is something that we take lightly. Poverty is not something that we take lightly. Abortion enables women to pursue their careers or their education or their dreams without an unplanned pregnancy standing in the way, or it prevents unwanted children from coming into the world, or disabled children who may suffer. These are all important and hard-hitting things. As my colleague Jay Watt said, there's a lot wrong with abortion, but there's only one reason abortion is wrong, because all of those justifications are assuming at the outset that the unborn is not a human being like you and me.
Although there's a shift in the debate, it seems to me, the shift, Megan, seems to be from whether or not this is a human being to whether that human being is a person. In other words, whether that human being has true personhood that counts. So now, because of the technologies that are available, sonograms and so forth, you can see this is a human being. There's no question whatsoever that this is a human being. So now you have to say, yes, it's a human being. I have to admit it's a human being. But what makes that human being count is whether we say that human being has developed to a stage where we can call it a person.
That's right. That's a different type of debate. We've gone from a debate over science to a philosophical debate. It's a philosophical question that asks, what is it that makes human beings valuable, or what is the thing that would determine that we no longer have a mere human being, we have a valuable person here? And there are really only a couple of ways to answer that type of a question. One of the ways that society answers it, and I would say predominantly our society answers it this way, is that a human being can be made into a valuable person based on an instrumental reason or a functional reason. This is the value system that I wrote about in the article that is depicted in the Gilead, this imaginary world that Margaret Atwood wrote about, but also the one that we ourselves live in, where human beings are attributed value based on their abilities or their traits. On college campuses, it could be anything from their ability to contribute to society to some kind of cognitive ability. All of these things are functional and vary from individual to individual. And the pro-life argument is that if we ground our value there, if we say that one of those reasons is the thing that would give us rights, first of all, we have to answer the question, the grounding question, as what philosophers call it, why is it that trait and not something else? Why is that the value-giving trait? And then secondly, we have to explain to what degree that trait has to be present, because traits and abilities come in varying degrees. And if we're going to ground our value on something like cognitive function, then we're going to end up with a society that says some human beings matter far more than others, because we have a sliding scale when it comes to that. So the only answer that ends up making sense philosophically is that we are beings of intrinsic worth. There is a basic human dignity that underlines or underscores everything else. It's the one thing we all have in common from the point we come into existence to the point of death. And, you know, long after that, I believe Christianity is true.
You know, Francis Schaeffer once said that this would be the watershed issue of our day. Do you agree that it is?
Absolutely. If students can make the connection that when we answer the questions, what does it mean to be human and valuable, the way that they answer those when it comes to abortion is going to impact the way they answer those questions for every other injustice that we're looking at.
When I hear you speak, I hear Scott speak, I think, you know, if everybody could articulate this message as clearly as you do, we would put an end to the abortion mythology, the mythologies that are being propagated by people like Michelle Wolf. I mean, she's making arguments. They're very sophomoric. They're really, quite frankly, stupid arguments. And yet the audience is applauding. And when I see that, I think how critical it is that the Christian in the pew, those who take the sacred name of Christ upon their lips, are equipped to communicate answers in this regard with clarity.
Yes. Well, as you said a few minutes ago when you made that quote, you know, if I can control your media and your music, if the storytellers drive the culture, we can look at that biblically when we look at the book of Daniel. You know, when Daniel was taken to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, brilliant military leader that he was, put those young men through basically a Babylonian Harvard, and the first thing he taught them was the language and the literature, because he knew if he could teach them those things, he would make them Babylonian. The stories drive the culture, and I think that if we can understand not only the truths that underlie this issue, but the fact that when we grasp these truths and walk in them, when we understand our inherent dignity endowed by God and walk in it, we have the ability to tell others far better stories about themselves than Michelle Wolf might be telling at the moment or than the culture is telling them.
One of the areas that you are passionate about, because you wrote the article that I alluded to earlier, Seeing Red, The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. What inspired you to write that article? Why is this so critical for people to grasp from the standpoint of cultural apologetics? And let me back up a little bit. I was just at a conference, and one of the things I learned at that conference is about some of the ways in which kids are watching and using media outlets that are changing their worldviews, and so often we know nothing about it. For example, I heard about a game called Minecraft. 144 million subscribers. And when you think about those subscribers, they're in not the millennial generation, but Generation Z. And when you ask them about Facebook, they will look at you and say, that's for old people. They're involved with these kinds of video games, interactive mediums that are changing their worldviews. And oftentimes we don't know anything about it. So we're talking to them and we're speaking one language. They're speaking a completely different language. So it's like we're passing ships in the night. And I think it's critical for us to engage cultural apologetics. And that's what you did in the journal article, again, titled Seeing Red. I think it's critical that we know what the culture is feeding people, because so often they're more impacted by cultural norms than they are by Christian norms learned in Sunday schools, which are becoming increasingly irrelevant.
Yes, when I think about the games like that, particularly I've been with 3 weeks here with students of that particular generation, and one of the things that we address with them a lot is, because we're a worldview-driven conference that's going on here, they're hearing a lot about the different worldviews and how those worldviews inform, particularly our anthropology, or the way we view what it means to be human.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and speaker Megan Allman. It is important to understand the sources of our modern distaste for the teaching of the doctrine of hell, for they are part of the strongholds characteristic of our times. By critically exploring these sources, we can best instruct children in the essential biblical doctrine of hell and avoid an actual abuse of greater severity, which would be their being unaware of its reality. All Christian parents and educators should read Is It Abusive to Teach Children About Hell? By Rebecca Valerius in the current edition of the Christian Research Journal. Subscribe to the journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. We'll be back with more of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, so stay tuned.
Christians today are now facing friendly fire from within the faith. There is a growing wave of former Christian leaders who are now rejecting Christianity and doing their best to make certain that you lose your faith too, which is why it is essential for you to be equipped in your faith. Paul Chamberlain takes these critics head on in his new book, Why People Stop Believing, to equip you with apologetic answers to defend your faith against those who want to see you stop believing. To receive your copy of Why People Stop Believing by Paul Chamberlain, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. Or just visit us online at equip.org. That's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. A major reason mindfulness has been successfully mainstreamed is that we are so overstimulated and chronically busy. Because mindfulness has entrenched itself in American culture, Christians need to investigate it thoroughly in order to determine whether it is friend or foe. Other topics include the Jesus of Mormonism, the philosophy of atheist Bertrand Russell, how does the human soul come into existence, the story of Morgan Freeman, not God, is it abusive to teach children about hell, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
With over 500,000 copies in print, Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer books were born out of his many years of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He's taken his on-air answers to questions and chiseled them until only the gems emerge. Questions involving biblical interpretation, cults, science, ethics, apparent contradictions, and much more. This remarkable collection of concise answers is now even better. My goal, says Hank, is to take the complex and make it simple and memorable. Receive your copy of the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI
and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Planned Parenthood's propaganda claims that the labels pro-life and pro-choice don't accurately portray how most people feel about abortion. But is it possible to be rationally neutral on the moral status of the unborn? Read Megan Allman's article, What's in a Name? A Growing Trend to Abolish the Labels Pro-Choice and Pro-Life in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Start your subscription today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and author Megan Allman in their conversation.
I think that one of the driving worldviews right now, or actually anthropologies right now, is a view of humanity. Nancy Piercy actually just addressed this in her book that came out in January, Love Thy Body. She was a student of Frances Schaeffer's and is brilliant in her own right. But this idea of this kind of rebirth of Gnosticism, as it were, a kind of a body-self dualism, and what that means is that there's the separation between the body, like the physical body, and what would be termed in the true self. So what this does is devalues the body, kind of puts it in this place of saying, well, my body is nothing more than a machine that I use to satisfy the desires that I have, I being my feelings-based center or my psyche. You hear students say, it just has to feel right. And that really informs some of the decisions they're making. So with something like Minecraft, I think it feeds that view of, well, I can do with my to and with my body what I want as long as it brings me pleasure, and I can kind of write reality in the way that I want to. After all, these are all tools for me to use that satisfies the true self, and especially in a society that is driven towards individualism and autonomy. And it escapes the fact that we live always in relationship to our Creator. There are limits to our freedom. It's a dangerous type of thing, but that's run rampant. You see it with abortion. You see it in the denial of if I can separate sex from its natural biological result. You see it in some of the other issues that we're facing that are kind of outside my purview as far as speaking goes, but homosexuality and transgenderism. This idea that my body is not as important as the rest of me, whereas Christianity has been contrary to that all along and says you can't do to and with your body whatever you want because your body is essentially part of who you are. And whenever you begin to do these things, it's harmful to you, which is consequently what the studies have been showing with the rise of anxiety and other dangerous thoughts that are out there. It's crazy.
You know, in The Handmaid's Tale, the regime is reacting to this worldwide drop in fertility rights. If you haven't seen the series, it's pretty graphic. And the state-mandated biblical vernacular is invoked over and over again, epithets like, blessed be the fruit. You know, of course, blessed be the fruit of thy womb, but they truncate it. Blessed be the fruit, or may the Lord open, as in may the Lord open the womb, the idea that God opens and closes the womb. These are posited in the series as skin-crawling epithets, and it's prescient of a police state in which we will soon live if America is under the repression of conservative courts. So there's this hysteria out there that we're going to have conservative courts, and because we have conservative courts, we're going to go back to back alley abortions, and we're going to have men controlling women. And it seems silly when you talk about it, but the audience is buying into it because the medium is carefully crafted to communicate this message.
Yes, and one thing that really bothers me about all of that, is the Margaret Atwood, when she wrote this book back in 1985, the premise of the story, or one of the many premises that she's running with, is if women lose what they term their reproductive freedom, that is their right to abortion, again, the rhetoric, then they're going to lose all of the other progress that they've made since suffrage, basically. And there's a real issue with that, as if all of these other goods kind of stand on that one, like an upside-down pyramid. If this one thing goes, then everything will fall. But what's wrong with that, even looking at abortion being this great good that women have, is this is not a society that is respectful of women. And it simply takes a perspective shift to see that this is a society that almost views being female as a disability in some sense. When a female's natural ability, biologically speaking, is to be able to carry a child, a great privilege that we have by right of how we're made or by design, and when society looks at that and says, no, that's a problem, we need to control that, that's not a society that views women as good or even equal. That's the society that views them as dangerous in some way or in the way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's something wrong when you now re-envision women. And you've written about this in your article. You envision women in stilettos, raking in six-figure income. That becomes sort of the idealistic woman. That is the thing we should always strive for as females. But this seems to be a false image of what constitutes womanhood. So I think women are being sold a bill of goods here.
Right. And I don't think that you would think this way, Hank. There's nothing wrong with someone who is in stilettos raking in six figures. But you're right that is somehow the idea of a woman's worth is equated to her ability to earn her wages, which was a large kind of message with the second wave feminism, as I understand it, as it rolled in. That women somehow needed to be able to do everything that men can do. I think I really appreciate Dorothy Sayers is one of my heroes, and she did not write a great deal about feminism, but she wrote a couple of essays that I really appreciated. And in one of those essays, you know, she kind of looks at it and says, to say that a woman is as good as a man is completely useless saying, unless we're going to understand at doing what. So she would view being female or male as you know, adjectives to the thing that we are first and foremost, and that is human. So the way that comes out in the article is when I talk about that secular feminism, when it attempted to kind of free women or liberate women from men, it missed the very important distinction between attributed value, which is that functional type of value I was talking about, and that intrinsic human dignity. That first and foremost, we're human, and women are gifted in so many different ways. So to say that it has to look a certain way is very limiting and not at all what it means to be female.
Yeah, I like that. In other words, there's nothing wrong with the image in and of itself. What's wrong is that it is a limiting factor. It is a microscopic piece of the whole, and that is being forwarded as though it is the whole.
Right.
And in The Handmaid's Tale, you know, it's pretty interesting. The boogeyman is the environmental toxins. That's why the birth rate has plummeted in the narrative that you're watching. In the real world, we might rather take a look at what we're talking about right now: abortion, euthanasia, same-sex sexuality, gender fluidity, and the like. That's the real boogeyman.
Right. Well, as you're pointing to, the view that this is the highest good for women has kind of dropped this idea into the well, that women need to hurry up and get established in their careers. They need to push harder and harder and harder to climb that career ladder and really set themselves up well before they can think about having a family, being married and having children, if that's a desire that they have. And the result of that, because school takes a long time. Some of these careers that women are certainly capable of doing take many, many years of study. And to say that you have to put off childbearing for such a long time has had some pretty devastating effects, even within our own society. I did quote some statistics in the article. Just between 1970 and just a couple years ago, 2015, you know, the average age of the woman had her first baby went up from 21 to 30 almost. And it keeps moving farther beyond. Women are waiting longer and longer to have babies. Some of them wind up waiting until after their ability to bear children is kind of dwindling. So we have kind of a rising infertility in our own country for that reason. In fact, our birth rate right now, and as of 2015, it was at 1.8 per family. We need at least 2.1 children per family, just speaking strictly numbers, to keep our culture alive, to keep going. And we've dropped below that. I think this is a huge contributing factor.
It's
there are
huge.
Consequences to that.
Yeah. Yeah, there are huge consequences. I think it's telling that Margaret Atwood, very much like Margaret Sanger, by the way, had a steely devotion towards abortion. Her concern was state-sanctioned surrogacy, a brutal form of female subjugation. But the real surrogacy is women being coerced into being surrogates for same-sex couples or for artificial reproductive technologies in general, I think.
Right. Ideas always have consequences, and so do technologies, even unintended ones. So when we look at reproductive technologies that are kind of on the forefront right now, we have to understand that like anything else, a technology is a tool. It's the way that we use it that can be very, very good or not good. And the struggle of infertility is a real one that is felt within the churches, in part because of these ideas and in other part because we live in a very broken world. And that doesn't need to be overlooked. I think that needs to be considered strongly. But within that, we have to look at the boundaries. What should we be able to do with these technologies? And surrogacy is one that causes it gets messy. It gets very messy very quickly because we're dealing with human beings. And anytime we start to go down the road of making or creating a life for the express purpose of adopting out that life, I mean, the first big door we're walking into is that children look more like commodities than they do gifts. That's an issue. Children are not products. But also, it does, as you say, kind of exploit women, especially those who are desperate for money and are looking at this for a way to make money, the use of their bodies. Again, back to the anthropology I was pointing out a little while ago, this idea that the body is just a tool. It's not as important as the rest of me, and what I do with it doesn't really affect me unless I want it to. But that's not the way reality works. And so we're playing dangerous games, and human beings are suffering because of it.
I love what you just said. I mean, I don't love it because of its implications. I love it because of its correctness. But children are being viewed as commodities. And when children are being viewed as commodities, they become increasingly viewed as disposable. I mean, that's a logical extension of what happens when you commodify children.
Yes. I don't think this is always intended by people. But I do think that somewhat in the reproductive technology, just the word reproduce, it's very industrial instead of procreate, which is what used to be said. But when we begin going down this road, it's almost as if you know, you're listening to people talk about shopping for an appliance with these particular features, which, of course, is the danger of some of the tools that we're using, that we're, as C.S. Lewis said, we're going to conquer our own nature, but then who will have won? But the flip side of that coin is if we can produce them and they are things and we can choose how they are and we have this power over them, then certainly we can dispose of them if we see fit. And that's where abortion on demand rolls in. And what we're seeing is with the capabilities we have, particularly of detecting problems in the womb, if the child has some kind of genetic abnormality or is diseased in some way, that they're disposable. In fact, I was doing some reading recently with different cases that talked about parents who choose not to have prenatal screenings or parents who have the prenatal screenings and find out that their child has an issue and then refuse abortion. Those parents are often labeled irresponsible.
That's incredible.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and speaker Megan Allman in just a few moments. A major reason mindfulness has been successfully mainstreamed is that we are so overstimulated and chronically busy. Because mindfulness has entrenched itself in American culture, Christians need to investigate it thoroughly in order to determine whether it is friend or foe.
be sure to read Thinking Through Mindfulness, Psychology, Religion, or Both by Sarah C. Geis in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Start your subscription today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man will return in just a few moments.
What happens when an up-and-coming European bioscientist goes from being a Darwin disciple to a Darwin defector? Sparks fly. Heretic is the story of a scientist that follows the evidence wherever it leads. Heretic by Maddie Laisola and Jonathan Witt traces Laisola's investigative path to show how the evidence points more strongly than ever to the original biotechnologist, a designing intelligence whose skill and reach dwarf those of even our finest bioengineers and leaves blind evolution in the dust. You won't want to miss this journey from Darwin to design. To receive your copy of Heretic, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271, or just visit us online at equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. It is important to understand the sources of our modern distaste for the teaching of the doctrine of hell, for they are part of the strongholds characteristic of our times. By critically exploring these sources, we can best instruct children in the essential biblical doctrine of hell and avoid an actual abuse of greater severity, which would be their being unaware of its reality. Other topics include Called to be Mere Ambassadors, The Story of God with Morgan Freeman, The Jesus of Mormonism, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. Pastor Martin Niemöller spent the last 7 years of Nazi rule in concentration camps. Reflecting on the camps where millions would die, Niemöller said, "First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." To ensure that your voice is heard and that someone is speaking for you, become a member today of CRI's support team. Simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. Well, let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Megan Allman, author of Seeing Red: The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity, and Hope.
The Handmaid's Tale, I want to get back to that for a moment because I glossed over that very, very quickly. You're an expert on that series. Talk about the background and the plot so that people know what we're talking about if this is the first time they heard of The Handmaid's Tale. Of course, if it is, you've probably been living under a rock because this is a cultural phenomenon.
It's everywhere. If you're seeing pictures of red nun habits of people protesting reproductive rights or abortion rights, then that's where it's coming from. Now, Margaret Atwood is a Canadian author and a feminist. She's an advocate of abortion, but she's written several books along these lines. She's very interested, I think, in displaying where cultures can take really bad ideas and put them into play, and bad things happen to people, this being one of them. So she's created this fictional world that she calls Gilead, again, taking these biblical kind of terms and references, you'll hear several of them, in which a group of very fundamentalist and violent so-called Christians, who call themselves the Sons of Jacob, have violently overthrown the government and taken over. And they've created this whole patriarchal society of what is left of modern America. At this point, I think they're kind of shrunk to more or less New England. And in that society, women have lost all of the privileges that they currently exercise. So women do not read, they do not hold jobs, they're not allowed to handle money. They are more or less fit into a functional kind of caste system that's created there. There are the wives of the commanders, who are the men who kind of hold power in the society. The econo wives would be kind of the working class. There are Marthas, who take care of household domestic duties. And then the handmaids are at the bottom rung of society, and they are kind of enslaved but also revered because they are the only fertile women who are left. And these handmaids serve the family by serving as forced surrogates. It is a society that enforces a state-sanctioned rape, as it were, so that these handmaids bear the children for the families in the society but never get to be mothers themselves. In fact, they are turned into property. Their names reflect that. Our main character's name is Offred, which is literally of Fred, Waterford being her commander.
Well, when you describe this show, Megan, I have this confliction, and I'm sure a lot of people do in the Christian world. Maybe I should put it this way. You don't need to get into the gutter to know it smells. So the confliction is that on the one hand, you think maybe I should steer Christians away from these kinds of shows. On the other hand, if they become cultural phenomenons and you don't know about that cultural phenomenon, it's kind of like what I was talking about when I was talking about Minecraft. If you don't know about that, you can't speak the language of the person that's being indoctrinated by it. So it's sort of important with respect to cultural apologetics to know about these things so that you can counter these things. What's your view on that? Should we watch shows like this? Should we steer away? How should we process this?
Well, I had to struggle through that when I took the job and said, I will go ahead. I would like to research this and see what's going on. Because for me, I had friends who were talking about it, and I wanted to be able to address it with them because I knew it was alluding to something that wasn't quite right. And boy, did I find out. So I actually began by reading the book, and then I went and then I watched the show, the choice being because I knew I was going to research it for the purposes of writing this article and responding to it. I think I am careful in how I recommend the show. I definitely put a warning label on it as to what someone will see or choose not to see, as it were. It can definitely fast forward through certain things or block them out given modern technology. But it is very dark and disturbing, and it's meant to be. The show does not withhold the reality that's taking place with these rape scenes. It's very difficult to even think about or talk about, much less watch play out in a drama. So in that sense, be warned. In the other sense, this has taken the world by storm. And there are young women who are cheering Offred on. And when you follow the story, you can't help but do that. You want her to hang on to her identity in all of this, in this terrible world that she lives in, which is kind of the glimmering of hope that's there. You can't tell a good story, even an entertaining one, without Christian worldview values somewhere woven through them. So my view on that is sparingly. I think it takes some reason and discernment. And for me, because I choose to work with young people and want to know what it is that they're taking in, I have to watch this show with a particular prayerful stance going into it, knowing I'm watching this to think about it, and it's going to be hard. And it was.
I think the principle here for me is that you have to be so familiar with the truth that when a counterfeit looms on the horizon, you know it instantaneously. And I sort of learned that principle as president of the Christian Research Institute in studying cults. There's no end to the number of cults that you can study. And some of the greatest cults today are actually philosophical naturalism, narcissism, and scientism, and so forth. These are the cults that are making the biggest impact on the minds of people today. It's not just Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and so forth. But the point is, Satan packages and repackages the lie in so many different ways that it's hard to keep up with it, even if you do it as a vocation. So I've always told people, Megan, that you need to be so familiar with the truth. It has to be part of your DNA. And then you'll spot the counterfeit. And then when the counterfeit is communicated to you in a cultural narrative, in a movie, in a series, whatever, you're going to have an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within you, and you're going to be able to communicate it with gentleness and with respect.
I agree 100%, and I'm grateful for the teachers who have taught me not just the Scripture, which is my first and best teacher in the Holy Spirit, but the teachers who have responded to the things before I've gone to them to be able to walk there and consider and find and root out the bad ideas from the good ones.
You're mentioning that this is no longer fiction based on what Margaret Atwood is saying. She's saying in interviews and so forth that this is not fiction. She thought she was writing about dystopian society, but this is actually the society in which we live today. That's the narrative that has been foisted upon us. This is what is happening today, and therefore, if we don't have a revolution in our time, our democracy is done.
Yes, it's happening today, and it's not happening for the reasons that this show would claim, or that that more secular society who is championing the show is thinking. It's happening from the ideas that we wrote about in the article and others.
How are the root causes different between Gilead and the America we live in today?
Well, the root causes of this version of what's happening, this functional society, is some of the very things we've been talking about. I think it's a combination of factors. I mentioned three in the article. One was secular feminism, this idea that that a woman's worth is something that is functional. Abortion on demand, which flows kind of out of this idea that because of function being the highest good here, that we wait and establish careers and have commodified children to some respect and now have this abortion on demand, the ability to separate sex from pregnancy, which is abused. And then, of course, the functional system as just period. Anytime that we begin to say human beings matter because of something that differs among human beings, we create unjust societies.
It is so critical for all of us to be ready to give an answer, and I think that you do that with great clarity, and we're very, very grateful for the role that you're playing. And I think what you're saying, and perhaps you can elaborate on this, is that you can't do the job alone. This is not the job that is to be done by the hired gun. Every single believer needs to be involved in the process. And if every believer is involved in the process, we can have a solution to the cultural chaos in which we live. You look at the cultural chaos, and it oftentimes is just, it's tantamount to throwing up your arms and saying, there's no chance whatsoever. The culture has won. We've lost the cultural wars. And so in some eschatological paradigms, just wait until you get raptured and let the world go to hell in a handbasket. But really, we can win the culture wars. You think about the fact that in Roman society, first century society, girls were considered to be worthless. And those girls were left wailing before the statue of Nero, waiting to expire. This was a horrible society, and yet Christians turned that society upside down. And the reason I want to end with this is I don't think we should throw up our arms. We shouldn't have a defeatist attitude. It's a sinking ship, and therefore give up. We can change the culture, but it really means that we grasp a hold of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Christ rose. Because he rose, we have hope. Because he rose, we know we can stand against the culture, even to the point of shedding our own blood, because we know that there is another life. And so we can make this life count without being politically correct, without being popular, without looking to prosperity. We can make a difference. We can turn the world right side up, but it takes believers being counted in the process. And I suppose that's a message you want to communicate.
Absolutely. My favorite part of my job when I'm talking about the abortion issue with students, aside from addressing the injustice and bringing awareness to it, because that's vitally important, is that I get to tell them a story about who they are and why they matter, a true story. And I get to back it up with philosophy and then point to the scriptures. And to the degree that people are willing to believe and understand who God has made them to be, that when we place our trust in him, he adopts us and empowers us with the same Holy Spirit that raised him from the dead, that we have the ability to walk in a world and not be defined by it at all. So I think we live in fear of what others might think or what the cultural climate is like, or that we're not the professional, or that it's too hard, or that someone else will do a better job. I know I face those fears every day, but to the degree I understand that he is working through me, I can kind of look at the world and do as Paul did, who certainly embodied this so well when he faced the most powerful people in the known world of his day. And he says, you can do what you want with me, but you cannot have me. That's a dangerous way to be in a world like this one, in the best possible sense for Christ, because the world does not know what to do with people like that. And it is attractive, and it is wonderful, and it gives you the footing to be able to pour into the lives of others, because you're kind of free from being in bondage to yourself when you give that sin to Christ who died for it.
Well, Megan, I loved having you on the podcast, and I will pray that God continues to use you for his glory, for the extension of his kingdom, that it gives you strength and health along the way, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with author and speaker Megan Allman in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. To get a biblical perspective on current events, religious movements, and cultural trends, and gain the discernment skills you need to defend your Christian faith, subscribe to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online at equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write the Christian Research Institute at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
Christians today are now facing friendly fire from within the faith. There is a growing wave of former Christian leaders who are now rejecting Christianity and doing their best to make certain that you lose your faith too, which is why it is essential for you to be equipped in your faith. Paul Chamberlain takes these critics head on in his new book, Why People Stop Believing, to equip you with apologetic answers to defend your faith against those who want to see you stop believing. To receive your copy of Why People Stop Believing by Paul Chamberlain, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271, or just visit us online at equip.org. That's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. A major reason mindfulness has been successfully mainstreamed is that we are so overstimulated and chronically busy. Because mindfulness has entrenched itself in American culture, Christians need to investigate it thoroughly in order to determine whether it is friend or foe. Other topics include the Jesus of Mormonism, the philosophy of atheist Bertrand Russell, how does the human soul come into existence, the story of Morgan Freeman, not God, is it abusive to teach children about hell, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.